Hi, this is Mimi, and welcome to my podcast, The Lovely Becoming. Today's guest is Tai Sky, who is a psychotherapist based in the Los Angeles area. She founded an incredible group program called Worthy Women Rise, and we've met through Instagram, and you just blew me away. We've gotten to do a little bit of consulting, and early on in my career, I was mentioning how I was just having a really hard time with giving and giving, and Thais was able to give me some really good wisdom about noticing the discomfort and noticing when I felt like I needed to make up with physical gifts or like fix my clients and help them to heal. And that's been really special to me. So I'm really excited to have you on. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Mimi. It's so good to connect with you again.
Yes, I'm so excited for others to get to know you. What do you do and what do you love?
What do I do? Well, I do many things. Like you said, I'm a therapist. I work with individuals, couples, and I run groups. And I'm also a writer. I like to speak and teach and all of those other titles. But really, I think part of the core of what I do is help people get curious about themselves. I tend to find that the more that we know ourselves, the more free we become. And that kind of like idea has really led me into some really beautiful journeys of my own healing. And let's see, what do I love? I love connecting with people. I love writing. I mean, you know, I come to this work with a lot of my own brokenness, a lot of my own wounding, a lot of my own really painful patterns that at the time, gosh, when I was 18, so a long enough time ago, felt like I was the only person in the world who experienced those things, eating disorder, perfectionistic tendencies, depression, anxiety, the whole gamut. I think that many young people experience, but I thought I was alone in it and that my problems were very unique to me. And because I felt like I was alone, I really felt like I needed to start to find something to help me. And that led me into the wellness world and spiritual and yoga and, you know, all sorts of spiritual ideologies, really in the hunt for what makes us human. How can we repair the things that hurt? How can we tend to what hurts in ways that feel really compassionate and spacious? Can we actually change, or is it just about accepting? What is the whole kind of philosophy of what it means to be human? And it's been quite a ride, Amy. It's been quite a ride, and I'm very much still in this exploration. And I think this is my life calling. This feels like what I'm here to do.
I mean, the end, that was perfect. Oh my goodness. Those are such beautiful expressions and I know honest and hard experiences at the same time. And so I'm really grateful for you moving through that fear, that shame of being like, is it just me? Because you get to offer such connection and healing for others as well.
Yeah, it really is interesting how our wounding really tends to make us think that we're not worthwhile, right? And that's why I've been so curious with this phenomenon that I've called the worthiness wound. Like, what is that? What is this sense within us that we are so broken that we're actually worthless, right? Put another way, why do we find ourselves chronically feeling either too much and or usually it's both, not enough, particularly in relationships, but also in all sorts of contexts and environments? What is that? You know, where did this phenomenon come from in our childhood or within our culture? And how do we hold that so that maybe this feeling can be held, navigated, tended to, healed, you know, whatever language we want to put to it, so that it doesn't continue to paralyze us and continue to be the only belief? And that stems directly out of my own experience of constantly, you know, I'm pretty open about the fact that I'm not this healed person on a pedestal. I don't see myself as like the chosen one that is fully enlightened and in operating in a 5D dimension, bestowing my gift onto the world. I'm in the trenches. I'm in the process of figuring it out with everybody else. But I've become really fascinated with not only that, but how can I also, as another human who has been experienced, who has struggled so deeply, use my struggles in ways to support other people in theirs. And I think that that is a real gift and a challenge. As you shared at the beginning, right? We tend to be the givers, we tend to be the carers, we tend to be the people who want to give ourselves to others. And how do we also do that work while also honoring our limits, our boundaries, and our capacities, that we're not an endless source of giving, that we have to tend to ourselves as well?
I love this. And something that comes to mind for me is this idea that we're in different places in our journeys. And sometimes we have gathered more in one area and others teach us about another. And I'm kind of curious about that question that you kind of asked of, do we learn to accept that feeling or where does it come from so we can heal it? And I'm curious what you found at this point in your journey.
Great question. I think it's a tremendous paradox that when the desire to change comes out of a feeling of brokenness, not enoughness, too muchness, the very act of wanting to change perpetuates this idea that we are, in fact, too much and not enough. But it can be really hard to let go of that paradox and to imagine a way of relating to ourselves where we can honor that there are times when we're going to feel too much. There are times that we're going to feel not enough. That's not actually a reflection of our goodness. It's a state of being that we can explore and get curious about. And we can accept that while also changing and growing and transforming and becoming the best, you know, whatever we want to be. If we want to do that, we don't have to. But if we want to do that, I tend to find that people that I encounter, obviously, because I'm a therapist, tend to come to me because they want to grow and they want to change. And I find that part of the ways in which we can heal this, part of what's really important in healing something like the worthiness wound is to really have people in our lives who see our work and who are able to hold it when we can't. And that's what I'm finding right now in my own journey. I've often believed that I've had to be the strong one. I was a parentified child. I've had to figure everything out by myself. And therefore, something like the worthiness wound, I have to figure it out by myself through journaling, meditation, through books. I can give that may be some help from other people, but through books, you know, like I need to be able to figure this out through my own way of operating in the world. And it's taken time for me to realize there's actually something really humbling and also really important about letting other people in, whether it's, you know, a therapist, a professional, right? Somebody who has the tools and the skills to be able to hold you and can hold you in your worth so that you can start to internalize it as your own, right? It's this idea of analyzing other people. If you surround yourself enough times with people who are always consistently, reliably seeing you in a certain way, you cannot help but bring that inward. But oftentimes we deprive ourselves of that because, like I said, we feel like we have to do it all on our own, or we have to get to a point where we can do it on our own. And I think that that misses the mark of the ways in which humans really need each other. We need each other, right? We can't do this on our own. We've never been able to do this on our own, this whole life thing. We cannot. And also, like, emotionally speaking, we cannot. And the expectation that we should be able to is, I think, really, really killing us. It's really contributing to a lot of anguish inside a lot of people.
I think that's really apt because there's a lot of polarized conversations, and I won't speak too much out of scope and be mean about the concept of codependence, but it always strikes me that we are interdependent people. We need other people to learn how to co-regulate and to learn how to love ourselves too. And I think it's interesting how much we push that away. And in an individualistic society, it's very much contributing towards those messages about worth. You singularly have to contribute and be productive, as opposed to you are a part of something and that makes you worthy, or you are inherently worthy.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we really share, I think, a belief around the word codependency. I really struggle with it, and I don't tend to use it myself, because while I think there is utility in what it attempts to describe, it's become so pervasive in pop culture that it's lost a lot of its original meaning and has now been used by a lot of people as a weapon against their own needs.
Mm.
And it can really then complicate the matters, because what I find is that most, I work with a lot of women, and most women who really identify themselves as codependent, what they're really struggling with is, how can I be in relationship while also being myself, right? Like, mm-hmm. how can I be in relationship without falling apart, without losing my identity, losing my sense of self? And that tension between self and others, the solution isn't to not need others, mm-hmm. right? The solution isn't to cut people off. And the solution isn't to cut ourselves off either. There is somewhere in the middle that we have to find ourselves, and that's the work, right? That's the healing work, you know, that's the journey that we are invited to be on, so that we can learn how to be intimate and connected to people, and also, you know, secure within ourselves.
I appreciate that a lot. I think there's a lot of attachment that goes into it, and defining yourself and understanding your worth as not needing to be just given by others, but that other people help us shape our sense of self as well.
Yes, this whole conversation is in some ways quite silly to even talk about it, because it's so, in some ways, very basic. But the fact that we're talking about it means that it is so far removed from culture. Self is other. Like, we learn who we are through the eyes of other people. You know, if we're talking about in terms of like language of attachment, development, psychology, I mean, it's all there. Babies learn who they are. They learn about their affect. They learn about their emotional state through other people. This idea of co-regulation also encapsulates this. We learn of our identity, of our sense of self, through how other people relate to us and how we see them relate to each other and the world. So there's very actually little separation in that way between self and other. And that is, I think, partially what makes it so tricky, because people come and say, well, no, but people influence me too much. I actually don't know who I am without people around me telling me who I am. And so how is my healing going to be to have you help me? My problem is I need to be more independent.
Mm-hmm.
And the work actually is not to be more independent, but like what you said, to be interdependent. And we learn how to be interdependent through corrective, through healing relationships, through specific relationships that are created, like the therapeutic relationships, specifically to help an individual find themselves within relationship, right? So what gets broken in relationship, like our sense of self, our identity, our way of being, is repaired through relationships. It's just this idea that we got to figure it all out. Mimi, I have a real hard time with it. Speaking as someone who just 10 years ago would have told you, what are you talking about? Like, of course the answer is within yourself, right? Or even that idea, right? All the answers that you're looking for are within yourself. Or all you have to do is follow your instinct. All you have to do is follow your gut, your intuition. And where does intuition come from? Where does that instinct come from, if not through our past experiences? It's not to say that the answers aren't within. It's not that black and white. It's not to say don't follow your intuition. Of course, I would never say that. But to say that it's actually a lot more complicated than just, I either listen to my intuition and do it on my own, or I'm totally codependent and depend on other people for my worth. There's so much that gets missed if we're looking at it from such a binary lens.
Absolutely. I think one of the things we all do is we look for a concrete answer for what we need to change, because the discomfort, kind of going back to what I talked about in the beginning of what I've been learning from you, the discomfort of not knowing the answer, or the discomfort of the process being gray,
yes,
is so overwhelming.
100%. And I think this shows up then in the ways in which we seek healing, I use the word healing because it always made sense to me to think about emotional wounds similarly to physical wounds, and to think about healing as a continual process and journey. It's not a destination. It's not, we'll get to the point that we're healed. But I always loved it. I always loved this idea of healing. It just, to me, evokes such nourishing feeling thoughts. But I understand that for some people, they may not like it. But bear with me. You know, I think healing professionals get often caught up in that too, of the answer is to give definitive, I am responsible as the professional to give definitive answers. And we see this a lot in manualized therapies. We see this a lot in DBT. DBT is very structured. It's like, I'm going to tell you what was wrong with your thinking, and then we're going to correct that thinking, and they're going to give you the right thinking. And not only can that be very patriarchal, white supremacist, right? Like the normative culture is the one who tells you what the right thoughts are. It also, I think, misses the complexity, which is that ideally the healing relationship supports humans find themselves able to be with and play with and tolerate and dance with uncertainty and the nuances and the not knowing, rather than it perpetuate the need to split everything into good and bad, into right and wrong. This is the right way, this is the wrong way to think about something, right? So ideally, if you go to therapy and the therapeutic container, but in all healing relationships, the healer is really supporting the individual to find themselves in the uncertainty, rather than compress into specific answers. This is how you should lead your life, right? This is what you should do. Because who are we to say what people should and should not do? But I think you're speaking so aptly to the fact that, like, yeah, we live in such a polarized time, because I think we're facing with so much uncertainty about the state of our planet that we're clinging to certainty to help alleviate our anxiety, but it's not working. It's only creating us versus them mentality, which I, you know, I'm reluctant to speak about the world because it's a big place, but I'm not seeing it create more community. I'm seeing it create a lot more ostracization and cutoff and pain. And I'm troubled by that. And it hurts, you know, to see our culture in so much pain and to feel it, right, in our communities and in our worlds. And I just wonder, how can we help each other be okay with how much is unknown?
That's beautiful.
I think it's hard. I think it's hard to do. But maybe that's the quest of our life, right? Because as much as we want to stay in our anger and make the other person wrong and bad, we carry all of the traits that we also don't like in others, right? We carry it all within ourselves. So when we're pushing the other away, we're also pushing away ourselves. And I think we don't want to be doing that. Right. We want to be coming closer, making closer contact to all parts of ourselves. You know, we know this in spiritual communities, call it the shadow work, right? Reclaiming your shadow, your more difficult parts. But I just call it healing, right? Coming into contact, making ourselves known with the parts of us that we don't actually really want to know.
I think that's really helpful. And it kind of reminds me of something that's been on my mind. So this concept where someone will be in the news, they're saying like, oh, this person is a criminal. They're awful. I would never do that. They're so bad. Like, I am the opposite of them. And it's always been interesting to me. And I've always felt a little guilty and off where I'm like, that could be me.
Yeah.
What is stopping me, not from, you know, not admitting on here that I'm ready to do something, but that's a human. Like I really feel this closeness to, we all have parts of ourselves that are wounded, and we all have parts that are angry, and in the circumstances where our basic needs are taken away, in the circumstances where there's interactions of trauma, like it, there's so much compassion.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons why sometimes we're like, oh, they're evil, I can't believe they did that, is that it makes us feel like, okay, I'm okay. I have certainty that that is bad and I am good and I'm not going to hurt someone. Whether or not that's real because you're so different for some reason, But I think it scares us when we recognize, oh, we're all human. We're all capable of hurt and harm.
Yeah. You know, you asked me before we recorded, right, how it's going to be reintegrated back into social media. I took, you know, a 6-week break. And one of the reasons why I took a break and I come back and nothing's changed, so obviously it's something I have to continue to grapple with, is the ways in which what gets celebrated and supported on social media is the labeling. You know, and I could literally open my For You page on my Instagram right now, Mimi, and like show you, it's just thousands of posts, like how to identify a codependent, how your partner may be a narcissist, right? Like how to leave a toxic person, you know, and how to identify, how to name, how to label, how to, and it's seductive because again, it really puts a lot of what is uncertain into certain categories and labels. It gets a lot of likes, which then content creators want to be visible, and the algorithms of Instagram is not very friendly right now, or hasn't been in a long time for creators. So we're struggling with view counts and become desperate, and we then start to feed the monster of people who really want this way of relating to themselves in the world. And it's a ginormous beast that I am really reluctant to participate in, and really in touch with the ways in which I have, and how difficult that is for me to embrace. How do I use this platform that I built my business on in many ways and have met some of the most incredible humans? And I love writing and I love sharing. And I think I have some nice, interesting things to say. I don't know.
Yes.
And I hope that, you know, people want to hear it. So how do I do that without falling into this trap of making everything so easy to digest when life is so difficult to digest? And you're really spot on that we possess all of these qualities. We all do. I think we all have the capacity to kill somebody if we were put in the right enough circumstances. I don't think that that's such a far away idea, you know? And gosh, how is it that we are so committed to finding the fault in the other, you know, that the other is the narcissist, the other is the broken one, and we're the saint, when in actuality, we can all act narcissistically. We all have narcissistic parts, right? And all, like, I have certainly been the toxic person. I can give you the names and numbers of many people who could tell you easily the ways in which I have been toxic or wronged them. You know, again, it's like I'm not some perfect person. I, you know, hopefully I have developed the ability to navigate conflict at this point, but you know, I mean, I don't know, sometimes being human is hard, and I wish that we could find ways to relate to it where we could hold a little bit more nuance and a little bit more space before slapping labels onto each other. And I don't know if social media will ever be that place, just by the very nature of social media.
Yeah, there's so much that's exciting and nice, and those connections equally feel like I don't want to let go of these, but it's such a difficult space to be authentic and to be grounded in our worthiness and ourselves. And yeah, that algorithm just
it messes with your mind and your soul. It really does. I have a mentorship for, I call it depth coaches, or coaches who like to go towards more emotionally oriented work. And we talk about this often in my mentorship, because there's often such a feeling of guilt that we're participating in the very thing that we don't want to. There's often such a tension between what they see their peers saying and doing, and what they feel they should say and do, the ways in which we market ourselves. Like, how do I write this seductively? I can't promise anything if you work with me. We often won't know where we're going if you work with me. Gosh, I promise that I will bring the best of me, but I am not perfect. Like, how do I say that, right? Like, how do you say that? You know, I'm going to be authentic, and I'm going to hold this really incredible space that I've gotten a lot of training for, but I can't make any promises. That those are not what sell. I mean, let's be frank here. That's not what sells. What sells is guaranteed. What sells is I can heal your trauma in 3 weeks. what cells is, here is the five-step process. Cells is, here's a framework that is going to 100% apply to you, results guaranteed. That's what sells. So for those of us who find ourselves running businesses that require talking about it, it can really, but wanting to be ethical and wanting to be thoughtful, it can be really difficult. And oftentimes in my mentorship, we're just in it and we're just grappling with it because I don't have answers for them, mm-hmm. but at least they don't have to feel they're so alone in it. And that can be so restorative, but I don't know. Honestly, Mimi, when people say, you know, that this work isn't sustainable, like online marketing, I tend to agree that if we're always falling under the trap of what social media wants us to do, that is not sustainable. It's going to require a lot of inner work and a lot of support to create something sustainable when the gravity is pulling us down towards something that isn't. It's not impossible. I've been doing this for over a decade, and I don't think that it's, I'm not trying to be like a Debbie Downer, but I do think it requires a lot more intention, thought in order to do things differently.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And kind of touching on that self and interdependence play, I think an interesting phenomenon as well is the balance between trying to set boundaries and also recognizing that sometimes we leverage our vulnerability and we give away a lot of ourselves.
Oh, we're going there right now.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. When I first started this whole situation back in the day, before I even imagined it would be any type of business or anything like that, you know, I was just writing a blog, and it was called Living in the Know. Ooh. Okay. And it was about a girl and her yoga mat. Okay. This was back in 2010. And I was writing about my eating disorder and my healing journey of my eating disorder. And I put it all on the internet, you know? So that's where I come from. I come from people knowing everything about me. I mean, it was all there. And then I had a podcast, and then I had my Instagram. And again, it was like bearing it all. And at one point, and it's not that it felt like it was disingenuous or that I was using it to leverage people, but I didn't know at the time. It only in retrospect could I see that, oh, like there was a part of the vulnerability that was doing something really healing for me, but a part of the vulnerability was a way to get connection, was a way to, you know, get like-minded people together. There are so many different ways that we can connect. That doesn't necessarily mean spilling out your guts and soul and your hardest night onto the internet. And so from that point in 2010 to now, I've gone through such a massive metamorphosis of what I share online. Every step you can imagine, I've went through of how do I go from putting everything out there to now where I'm so reluctant to share so much of myself, my life on the internet, because for a couple of things. One, because I don't find it necessary to touch the hearts and lives of people. Not for me. I'm not speaking for anybody else, and I don't judge anybody for how they do it. I'm just talking about me. My mentees do it all sorts of different ways. I help people find their own way. So I'm not trying to say I'm the right way, but I've been also really interested in privacy. I've become really interested in how do I write honestly and vulnerably and potently, but also really protect my privacy. And that my life is not what I'm selling, right? My lifestyle, I'm not an object to be purchased. My life is not what I'm selling, you know, which is what I used to do. You know, lifestyle marketing, coaching is very much in that world. And it's been a huge grappling, because I imagine maybe why you're bringing this up is because you're grappling with it too. When you share things on the internet that you yourself are not quite settled into, it can feel like you're using the internet to give you something that the internet shouldn't be the one to give you. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, yes, 100%. I think it came up for me as I shifted from being a student to a therapist and had to be more mindful of if I post,
yes,
you know, authentically that I'm very sick today, I also have to consider
yes.
my session this evening. Are they going to be worried about me taking my stuff on?
Yes. Yes.
And that's important. And then I found myself sometimes telling stories where I'd create a conclusion and I'd find insight, but I never talked to that person about it. And it was almost like I'm not actually going into the discomfort and conflict with others. The internet is becoming like, well, there's going to be people who tell me I am doing this right. There's not a lot of honest feedback and there's not a lot of actual engagement. It was sort of a veneer. It felt like I was doing the hard thing in engaging, but I wasn't actually doing that.
Yes. Yeah. That's really wonderful insight. I imagine I probably have done similar things. And yeah, I also really admire the way in which you're able to name that sometimes we write about our hard stuff, but then we wrap it in a really nice bow on the internet. And it gives this impression that that's how life is, right? You have a conflict, you got this lesson from it. Ta-da! You know, like that's complete. When life is obviously so much more complicated and nuanced than that. And yeah, I really appreciate that.
Thank you. And honestly, the last we talked, I think you mentioned something about privacy and I was really struck by it. And you have a really good gift of like the things you say, something just clicks for me, which is really awesome. And so this privacy thing, I was thinking about it with work as a therapist and, you know, a lot of the work that I was trying to do to get my writing out a little bit more to continue to, because it was resonating with people and I like that feedback. And at the same time, I was like, okay, this algorithm is changing. And I think it's a very interesting time where there's the chance to hop on board with reels and videos and keep up with the next trend. And I was like, I just don't want to. And actually a friend had mentioned she was writing as well. And all my life as a therapist, I had kind of been like, I want to be like Glennon Doyle and Brené Brown. And then I was like, I don't want people to run into me on my morning walk or whatever and be like, Mimi, I want to be anonymous. I want to do the work that I love, right? Get to interact with people. But I don't want to be that, not even known, because that feels like a deeper meaning, but I don't want to be that recognizable and that linked with people I don't really know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Glennon Doyle is a great example of this because what attracts people so beautiful, so strongly to her work is her storytelling and how open she is. Her and Abby on their podcast, I mean, they share about the conflict all the time. People see themselves in it. There's a place and a time for that, right? But it's tricky when then you see your patients, right? It's tricky when then the next hour you're sitting in front of somebody and, you know, I'm a student of psychoanalytic psychotherapy. I'm a student of a very conservative in some way view of the ways in which the analyst, the therapist, been used as a, how do I want to say this? The words that people tend to use is this idea of neutrality, right? Or blank slate, blank screen, right? And people, lots of therapists now, contemporary therapists will be like, I'm not like your old school therapist. I'm not a blank screen. I am a human in the room with you. Right. So they're trying to make this argument that the blank screen therapist is like the cold, kind of stoic therapist that just sits there and tells you that it's your mom's fault. Right. Like this straw man of what psychoanalytic psychotherapy is. And that's not what I'm talking about here. There's a difference between being really human in the room. I'm a human. I feel, I use my emotions to understand what's happening in the room, what's happening with the other person. We use our emotions to, that's how we have empathy and compassion. And that's how we understand. I mean, my emotions, my humanity is never not in the room, but there is something that can happen that's really powerful when our patients are given space to imagine things about us. Because then what they start to do, the brain is not the most imaginative place. So if my mother used boundaries as a weapon against me, and I was never allowed to have boundaries, let's say, anytime I had boundaries, my mother would tell me I didn't love her, let's say, and now my therapist has a lot of boundaries, I'm going to imagine, if she doesn't tell me exactly why, I'm going to imagine it's because she hates me. Right? Like, I'm going to imagine that if she loved me, she wouldn't have boundaries. So she hates me. Now, if she were to sit there and explain to me, no, I don't hate you. You know, this is a derivative. It would take away from the process of me coming to terms with the fact that this person has never shown that she hates me. Is very consistent and reliable and shows up and listens to me. And I think she hates me. Now I have to grapple with the past, being in the moment alive with my therapist. So prophecy for me as a therapist is not just about being this cold, empty space, but about the gift of this, of my patients getting to have thoughts and feelings because they don't exactly know. And so there can be more room for that magic. Now, having said that, right? There are things that I feel called to share on the internet. And then if my patients follow me, they may read it and they may have feelings about it, at which point they're more than welcome to bring it in. And we can talk about that too, right? It's all grist for the mill. It's all can be worked with and thought of and talked about. But if we're going to add what we've been talking about, the power of privacy from a kind of like the objectification of lifestyle, right? If we're going to use privacy as a way, like you said, to not have to always be so known, so seen, so performative, right? That we don't want to perform. If we're going to use that, and we're going to couple it with the power that that privacy can then do for our work as therapists, I'd say that's a pretty good argument for why clinicians and healers of all kinds should think about it, you know? We each have to decide where we stand. And I think there's merit in thinking about beyond just this straw man, like, oh, I'm not like your parents' therapist, you know? I don't know who that is. I've never met anyone who's, I've never met a single therapist who is like cold in the psychoanalytic world. So I don't know who the straw man is, but it's a thing. People say it a lot. And I understand what they mean, but I think I worry sometimes about what they think they're saying because I'm not sure that's what they mean to say.
And it takes a very, again, binary, like either you talk about everything in your life. I'm going to text you and I'm going to tell you about my partner and I'm going to tell you every single thing because I want to be human. But I think there's also this unacknowledged piece that's you're disclosing a lot about yourself just by the way you show up in a room.
100%. 100%. It's such a good point.
And what you said too is we need spaces where that counter transference or that transference, I should say, can be reflected upon and have space. And so I don't look up, you know, things about, I mean, it's dependent on the therapist, but my current therapist, I'm like, I don't really think I want to know all those things about you because I mean, there's so much to be said about how I show up in the relationship with someone. And that was such a good example too. And what it means about the assumptions I'm making in a whole different context. And it shows a lot about where your body is at in the timeline of trauma, where it's like, are we stuck in the past or are we present in different connections?
100%. And that puts us in a really interesting place. That now I'm finding myself being back on Instagram, which is, so what do I want to communicate? But what do I want to do? Psychoeducation? Is that what I want my platform to be? I don't know. There's a bajillion psychoeducation. Is psychoeducation what people need? Because I'm not sure if the language of therapy being tossed around is really all that useful. Yeah, I think in some ways and sometimes, I'm going to be totally honest that I don't know. I don't know where I find myself because I'm just in the mess right now of figuring out how I want to use my voice. I want to use my voice, right? I feel called to use my voice. I want to write. I want to be out there. I love conversations like this. I love the ways in which we connected through Instagram because of your beautiful content. So, you know, I don't want to disengage completely, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure how I want to do it. And that's a really difficult place to be, a place that I think makes me want to run and not deal with it. But I'm here, I'm figuring it out. And who knows, maybe one day it'll land, or maybe this is just my journey right now, is to be in the mess of it and to talk about the process as I'm in it.
Yeah. And how reflective of this whole idea that we want to run to certainty. We want to be like, okay, well, I'll just do psychoed and labels, or I just won't do social media at all. And it's like calling me out too. I'm like, well, I'm done. I need to delete the whole Instagram. Or
I know, I hear you, which is why I so gravitate towards my podcast and why I love, you know, podcasts like yours, where we get to talk things out, which tends to add texture and context, and we get to slow things down a bit, and we get to connect heart to heart, you know, with another human. It's why, yeah, this medium sometimes feels a little bit more spacious in that way. Because yeah, there's a way that we, there's, here's what I kind of leave as like a message to people who tend to wonder, like, how, where do I start on my journey, let's say, on my healing journey? I know that sounds so cliche, but how, where do I start? You know, where do I start? And I'm like, start with what you're struggling with literally right this second, right? Like whatever is coming up for you right this moment. For me, right this moment, as I'm talking to you, it's about social media, right? Like this right here is the place to start, because it's not just about social media, right? It's about so much more. And you start to unravel the threads just starting exactly where you are. It doesn't have to be more complicated than that. You don't have to wrap your mind, try to rack your brain on like where to start. Just start with, what keeps you up at night right now? What, where do you find your mind going more often? The place to start, and we'll see where that takes you.
There doesn't have to be a end goal to start.
No, that's right. Oh, that's so beautifully put. That's right. Yeah. And there doesn't need to be a massive problem either. You don't have to have a label to start too, which I think goes to the demystifying therapy, right? Like you only need therapy if you have a mental health condition, you know, if you have a diagnosis from the DSM. It's kind of like saying you can only go to yoga if you can't touch your toes, you know, or it's like we can go because we don't need to be alone and figure everything out alone. And we can go because we want to cultivate more understanding of ourselves. And maybe that includes a diagnosis and maybe it doesn't, but we don't have to do it all on our own. And I think what you said is really beautiful.
Thank you. I have a little bit of a messy question.
Okay. I will probably give you a messy answer.
Perfect. Something I find really interesting is that a lot of times we see one person that we really appreciate what they say, but when do we ever talk about who shaped them, who influenced the different aspects of who they became? And so I'm curious about maybe like two people, maybe it's a teacher or a parent or a sibling or a friend. I feel like we never really get to tell those stories to people. So I wanted to hear about that.
I don't know if the question is messy in as much as it's a big question.
Yes.
I think I'm going to start with the queen herself, which is my mother. Queen as in like the number, the first, right? The number one, the most influential person in my life, because of all the ways in which she influenced me, both in wonderful ways and in traumatic ways. She's now lived within me. I think that's the difficulty thing about like mother wounds and mothers, right? Is that they're not just now a person outside of us. They're also the internalized and continues to be with us and something for us to continue to navigate. And then somebody that when I first really needed a teacher, I found Tara Brach, who is a psychologist and Buddhist teacher. And Buddhism I found really accessible when I was younger because it wasn't as quite dogmatic as other dogmatic, I don't know. Actually, I think more like I remember in eighth grade and reading that Buddhists believe that life is suffering. And I was like, sign me the fuck up, you know, like, yes. In all of my teen middle school angst, you know, like little Thais, like, yes, life is suffering.
What?
And always been into that idea. And so I found Tara Brach in my late teens, early 20s, and loved the fact that she was doing these lectures for free. And then she would record them on our podcast. And at a time when I had so little resources in terms of finances to have this teacher, you know, so accessible, teaching things that felt so accessible really opened me up to the possibility that there's something for everybody at any given moment in time. Like there's always something for something. You know what I mean? Like even without time or without money, whatever the resource is, there's always something that is there. You know, we just have to find it. I was very lucky to find Tara Brach, and I would listen to her podcast quite devotedly. And I really love her presence. And she's a very sweet talker. And I'd fall asleep to her. And she became in some ways like another mother, you know, and I developed a real relationship with the fantasy of her. I think I've only met her once. And she really carried me through for a good portion of time. And then, of course, I think lastly, what continues to land for me as a person who is most so instrumental are my two therapists. I've worked with one therapist for 10 years and my current therapist now. And I don't know where I would be without these incredible beings being so consistent and available and there for me. I don't know if I would be here without them. Oh, that's making me a bit emotional. We sometimes devalue hired help. Right?
Yes.
We devalue it because we shouldn't be getting it if we're having to pay for it. And I think that's a real tragedy because I think as much as the original tragedy is that we didn't get what we needed at one point in time, like as children, to continue to deprive that of ourselves because it comes at a cost, I think is another tragedy. You know, I don't think that we are doing ourselves a service by saying like, oh, but I pay her, you know, because I think these are the people that can actually do the most profound work with us because they're not family. They're different. They can offer something really different.
And I think a little bit of separation of the system that we find ourselves in terms of it's the capitalism part that means we need the money for therapy. That means, you know, care has to be sort of delivered in that way. And I find that fascinating. I've been thinking recently and noticing in my sessions, and I'd love to hear if you see this too, where if my therapist goes over time, I'm like, see, she cares more about me. She couldn't help herself.
Yes.
It's hilarious. I had a client say, you went over, see, that means I'm your favorite client. And it's like,
Yes. I think that is a very seductive kind of way of thinking about it. Because once again, the boundary, we view the boundary as an act against us, right? The fact that, you know, a therapist, let's say, ends always on the time means that they don't like us. Or, right, it means that their needs are more important than our needs. And wouldn't it be nice to be in a relationship, maybe for some of us for the first time in our lives, where our needs were first? Probably because we never felt like our needs were first, even with our original caregivers. So like, if our therapist can finally be the ones who will put our needs first. It gratifies something, doesn't it? It really feeds something, but it's feeding something because it's believing that that dynamic, that one person's need is more important, is still at play. Right? When the truth of the matter is, the relationship has to work for both people. Right? Like, relationships don't work if they don't work for both people. Now, therapy relationships are very unique relationships. They are not like any other relationship. And I think we have a hard time with that. So we try to make them look like other relationships, but they're not like other relationships. They're very, very different. They're very unique. There's a power dynamic, and there's the money, and there's the set time. I mean, it's all whatever, but it still has to work for both people. Just the needs look different. There has to be space for both people, you know, to have their needs. But yeah, it's exciting when we feel like we are the exception. For me, I just love when my analyst, when she laughs.
Yes.
Like making her layer is so important. Sometimes I'm like, wow, I just spent a whole session just trying to make you laugh. I feel like I need to entertain in some way in my own. Like, fascinating, right? What does that say about what I felt like I needed to do? Anyway, I don't remember what your original question was, but what I will say to that is that that is all grist for the mill, something to talk about with our therapist. Oh, I feel like you hate me because you always end our sessions on time. Oh, I think that you love me because you know, go over time. You know, all of that is such great, great material for the therapy.
Yes. That is so fascinating what you said about the dynamic still existing. I thought that was super fascinating about how you're assuming that the old dynamic is still at play. And this is a whole new relationship, and what that tells you about those old relationships, because it That's introduces right. what the dynamic was in the first place that you learned and developed.
That's the transference. So one of the things that I talk about with my mentees, something that's really important, right, is this idea of the frame, right, which is, again, an analytic concept, but it really refers to all the ways in which we hold certain boundaries as the professional, the healer, therapist, etc. So the frequency of session is part of the frame, the beginning and the ending. We tend to think that when we give people more time, we're giving them the gift. Again, so the frame, right, if we go with the back to the frame, because all connects. You know, starting our sessions on time, ending them on time. Yeah, starting them on time, ending them on time. It's a basic concept. It's actually very hard to do for many of us because we want to give. And we have this modus operandi that more time, that we're giving them more time, we're giving them a gift. But what actually tends to happen, particularly with the unconscious, is that if we are to feel like we can bring all of our complicated unconscious material into the room, it has to feel like it's going to be really held. It has to feel like it's going to be really, really tightly held because we're scared of the stuff that we have been pushing down for a long time. And if sessions now start to go on for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, while initially it may have felt like a gift, it may now also start to feel like, but are you giving me this extra time because you can't actually tolerate me, right? You're giving me this extra time because maybe, again, every patient is different. Every context is different. This is not true for all contexts in all cases, but it may start conveying this message of, I feel as the therapist incompetent to hold this. So I'm going to keep letting the session go on because I don't want to be the bad guy. I don't want to be the raw, you know, when really what we're communicating is that we're not holding the frame. And when we don't hold the frame, we may be communicating all sorts of things that we don't want to communicate. Now, if we are consistent with our frame holding, as consistent as possible, again, context is different and some flexibility is required. It's really contextual. I really hesitate to try to make it sound like it's not. It's very contextual. But if we have this idea now as healers that the frame is really important, starting and ending our sessions on time, trying to be consistent with our background, trying to be consistent in how we bring ourselves into the session, trying to create as much as possible consistency, what we tend to notice is that our clients and our patients are going to have all sorts of relationships and feelings about the frame. They're going to have all sorts of ways in which they push our frame. They always come late. They always come early. They always announce big things at the end, say, but you know, all the way. But now that you have a steady container, you get to see their behavior a little bit more clearly, and now that gets to be worked with. So for this example, right, that this is a reflection of the relationships that they've had in their lives are one in which boundaries are seen as something bad, right? It means that you don't love. And that's how you come into this relationship with your therapist. And now your therapist holds these boundaries that are very clear. All of these feelings are now going to have space to come up. Space that may not have come up because the therapist always lets you go off later, right? So again, it's obviously very contextual. It's really about the frame is our responsibility. It's how we make sure that we protect the sanctity and the reverence, the sacred material, our hearts and souls of our pain. It's how we protect it. It's the most important thing that we can do. And then however way our patients relate to the frame, that's all beautiful. That's wonderful stuff that we can work with and talk about and come to an understanding with and work through some old things. Because at the end of the day, Mimi, the relationship has to work for both people.
And that really reminds me of the beginning of our conversation where I was talking about it really brings out our own discomfort as providers. And it really brings out that sense of, I don't think you can cope, and it's my responsibility to make sure that you feel like I care about you. But what about letting people bring that to us and feeling and sitting in that space of, ooh, I feel uncomfortable that I can't fix your attachment trauma. It's painful to watch and to know that I'm going to be in the presence of a lot of pain.
Yes. And that is where our own therapy becomes so important, right? Sometimes in the field of mental health, there's this idea of, oh, you have to do your own therapy so you know what it's like to be the patient. And I'm like, that is not why I'm in therapy. Like, I'm not, oh, it's okay that your therapist is in therapy because they have mental illness too. And it's like, that's not why I'm in therapy. Like, all those maybe like parts of it, but I'm in therapy because in order for me to be a steady rock, in order to be as available internally to make space for all that my patients bring to me, in order for me to be able to come into contact with some of the most difficult, terrorizing, anguishing things that my patients bring to me, I need my own space where I can understand myself. Right. And if I don't have internal space, I may be tempted to try to create external space.
Ooh. Whoa.
I may try to compensate by doing more outside of me, giving gifts, getting the workbooks, emailing my patients with articles, like all these things that I hear people do, right, as ways in which I think we try to compensate for the fact that we are feeling really incompetent because we're having such a hard time holding, really making internal space for their material.
I'm shook.
So when we go into our own therapy, you know, and we make sense of ourselves and we understand ourselves, we get to learn how to use our emotions in the therapy. We feel a little less shaken when things come at us. You know, we feel a little bit more steadier. That's a really wonderful gift. That's, again, the frame, right? We get to hold a steady frame for which then our patients can feel safe to bring everything and anything that they want into the room. We got to make ourselves available internally. There's no shortcutting being a real skillful clinician. And I think we sometimes see, again, that manualized therapies, the workbook, as crutches, again, as ways in which we're trying to use the external stuff to make up for it. But that isn't sustainable, and that leads to burnout, and that leads to feeling resentful, and that leads to overgiving and, you know, setting up an expectation that now our clients are supposed to do something with it. Like, just sets up things that I think can interfere with what we're really wanting to do in the work.
And that slowness, that really leads to healing is what's sustainable for both the clients, because they're not expecting more than you were ever able to keep giving. And you're maybe not selling the things that are trendy, which is hard, but you're also able to slow things down. So you have capacity to be able to sit with pain over time. And that's what people need, is that continual presence. Whereas with these 6 weeks courses or something, it's like the provider is going to burn out and they're not going to be able to support your continual. And maybe that's also part of the reason why these bids for connection get so overwhelming, because you're not making space for it in your own work, in your own going to therapy, in your own self.
You summed it really beautifully. Perhaps I think what we're craving right now as a society, we're craving that in each other. We're craving meaningful dialogue, like I'm having with you right now. It feels so nourishing. We're craving space. But capitalism is telling us, no, go for that thing, but that thing, go get that thing, but it's faster, it's quicker, but the tools, but the skills, but the tools, but the tools and the tools, you know, like, no, go get that, go get that. And so then we think we're broken because we're going for that and it's not doing the thing. Because the most real changes I've felt in my life has been a result of a lot of time and continual showing up. Usually the types of things that really have shifted within me were not things that happened very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just a totally different way of sustaining ourselves. And again, I think the nice thing is that we're out here, you know, the you and me's of the world, we're out here, we're doing it. And it's so wonderful that people get to find us. And I just kind of want to, any listener, like, there's more of us out there. Amy and I aren't the exceptions. There's people out there, but they're often not the ones that are, you know, screaming from the rooftops. And that means it takes a little bit more of a commitment to find. But it's worthwhile when we can find it.
Yeah. I like that.
The slowing down and the nourishment. We need to slow down and pay attention if we want to be nourished. But if we're, and of course now we can talk about like why it's so difficult to slow down. And in many ways we're trained not to slow down. In some ways it can be, for some people, a way of navigating trauma response. For some people it may be, you know, the way in which the internet and our culture, you know, we may have been glorified as a child for being forgotten. There's many reasons for why it may be really hard to slow down, but part of slowing down means coming into ourselves, and that can feel freaking unbearable. So again, where we struggle to slow down, where we struggle to sustain, where we struggle to feed ourselves something delicious or be receiving. How hard is it to receive? My goodness, it's so hard to receive good things from people, not because there is a lack of them, but because we're going by so fast, we don't trust it, all the reasons. That's the work, right? The ways in which we refuse to slow down, blah, blah, blah. That's the work.
Are you accepting new clients?
My caseload is really quite full, but maybe one more client or so. Yeah, I also have an in-person group that I run here in LA that I am accepting patients into. Those are the two kind of ways right now. But people can always reach out to me and we can talk about my offerings and how we can stay connected if they would like. They can go to my website, aisky.com, go to my Instagram and see me struggle in real life. But if they want a non-struggling taste, they can go to my website. Things are a little bit like that.
The only place you'll find perfect people is the curated website.
100%. If you want the curated perfect taste, you can go onto my website. And if you want the messy figuring out taste, you can go to my Instagram. I also have a podcast that you can find me at, Reclaim with Taste Guy.
Yes.
And I think that's where I'm at.
Listen, you've got one chance. It's one spot. Another offering. Call fast.
You should be my marketer, Mimi.
I got you.
You on my social media.
Speaking of nourishment, what are your favorite foods?
Oh my gosh, Brazilian food. Come on. Come on. Brazilian food, rice beans. Oh my goodness. Farofa. Oh, that's where that shit is at.
Yes.
Brazilian food. I also love Japanese food. I'm a
Ooh.
real big fan of Japanese food. Sushi is good. I mean, oh God, I mean, come on. I love pasta. I mean, I could just go down of all the amazing things. Any bread, carb situation, like with cheese. I mean, come on. How is every bread and cheese combination in the world like so delectable? You know, from pizza, hamburger. I mean, it's all good. I love all food. I love all food. Love that.
Oh my
Love
God.
that.
The question I ask everybody, how are you becoming?
What does that even mean?
You'll have to figure it out. I don't give hints.
I love the idea of becoming, right? This idea, it's a verb that has a lot of excitement to it and a lot of hope to it. And I think those beautiful things sometimes when things are feeling really hard to remember that there's always a next iteration of ourselves. We're never really it. You know, we are it, we are becoming it. We aren't just always it. Sometimes, like at the end of Worthy Women Rise, I like to remind the participants, you know, you are the woman you've been waiting for, you know, like you're, and that comes from a poem, and I'm forgetting who wrote that line, but it goes something, you are the one who you've been waiting for, something along that. I don't want to like pick someone's heart, but you know, I say like you are the woman that you've been waiting for because oftentimes we want to be saved, yeah, and that truth is like we don't need to be saved. I mean, we may feel that, and that's something we can work with, but you're it, you know, and how what a gift that is that you are everything that you want for you. I mean, you're a magical human, and you get to be that for yourself. And where we may feel like that's not true, it's where the work lies. So I will take your very confusing question and raise you a confusing answer.
Lovely becoming. Oh my God. This was amazing.
Really nice. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate this conversation. I'm gonna be munching on some of the things we talked about for a long time. So thank you for this connection and the gift of you in the world.